This Dharma talk was given to the Clearway Zen Sangha by Lotus Vu. This talk is made available free of charge. More information about Clearway Zen can be found at www.clearwayzen.ca.
So, I've received the request to give a talk today about the world that we live in today, full of conflict, instability, and war. And as many of you know, I'm not a stranger to that. My family background is such that I was born at the end of the Vietnam War and sort of embody the living legacy of that war in my own family and myself for a long, long time. And growing up with Thich Nhat Hanh, with his activism, his engaged Buddhism during the war and after the war, his efforts to heal and open bridges, dialogues, and connections between people. Now, I come across a poem that I'd like to share with you all. Pretty relevant. To the experience of someone who is witnessing all this changes in the world right now, and someone who experiences all of this suffering, all of the changes and the suffering that might be surrounding us. The poem is from William E. Stafford, called "The Ritual to Read to Each Other." If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world. And following the wrong God home, we may stir, miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood, storming out play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. This is a pretty moving poem and quite relevant to the times we live in now, the experiences of many around the world with conflict and upheaval being felt throughout the world, the instability that we're seeing unfold. And for myself, a student of history, a repetition of the pattern of ignorance and suffering, human history, So what do we do about this? We encounter such challenges and look out to the world and see these kind of things happening. Well, I tell you, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, and it rings very true and powerful to me as a child as it is now, you cannot find peace outside if you can't find yourself. The world might be in conflict, but if you can find the peace in yourself, then you are a beacon of light amidst the dark. How does that work? If we look out to the world and we're affected by the world, we feel helpless. We feel despair. We feel the pain and suffering of others. And then we get hijacked into that. I think of the health professions called compassion fatigue. But I wouldn't call it compassion fatigue. I would call it empathetic fatigue, because compassion is very different from empathy. Empathy is, you know, when you feel the suffering of another, and ultimately, as a mammalian makeup, you're going to sense that suffering in yourself. It resonates in yourself when you see it in others. And it's almost an automatic process. You can't help it. It is a part of our inheritance, our biological inheritance. There's a lot of science that backs this up. We mirror other mammalian system, their experiences to our own. And that empathetic response is hardwired to us. But what happens when we get overwhelmed by that hardwire? We look at the suffering of others, and suddenly that suffering becomes our own, because it stirs our own system, our own genetic, biological makeup, and it stirs our own sense of experience in the past, sometimes our own sense of helplessness. What can I do about this? I'm so helpless in the world that there's so much suffering, so much conflict, so much upheaval. I'm totally helpless to do it. Well, that's resignation. And that's not the path that Buddha taught. That's certainly not the path that Thich Nhat Hanh took. It's certainly not the path that I took. I grew up trying to find the balance with this. So, I was in a lot of activism, anti-war activism, protest, and you name it, hunger strikes in front of, you know, City Hall. Card-carrying member of the NDP for a long time. Working for social justice way before what people, you know, there was a term social justice, you know. Protesting against, you know, prisoner of conscience, with Amnesty International and different organizations. And I can tell you that my experience is such that if you don't have peace in yourself, when you're involved in that kind of activity, you are moved by the suffering. You are moved by your own suffering. And in that movement, there's no clarity to be able to truly give, to truly be present to the suffering of others. So it is in our inherent and most important practice to be able to be awake and aware to our own draw, to our own attachment to that suffering. And sometimes that attachment is not healthy because we identify with our past suffering. So we kind of like our suffering ego or identity ego of past suffering can connect to the suffering of others. Yeah? And it's the merging of two egos connecting through the experience of suffering. But that's not really a very objective way of approaching how we can help others. Now, I work as a psychotherapist and I specialize in trauma and complex trauma. So I sit and listen to a lot of people sharing about their suffering, their past experience. And you know, therapists have, and a lot of mental health and health caring profession as well, has the issue of challenging part of experience, what's called vicarious trauma, right? When somebody shares their trauma, their experience, their suffering with you, you take some of that on. And then it becomes your baggage to carry. I can tell you as a Zen teacher, you know, I've listened to a lot of people suffering over the last 15 years of teaching. And way before that, I've listened to a lot of people during my activism years, you know, because I come across a lot of people with mental anguish and suffering. And somehow, you know, I'm a good listener. So people like to just kind of share horrible stories with me. But that's their way of healing, right? And I had to, you know, I honored that. And in a way that helped me to learn about my own suffering and the suffering of others as well, to have compassion for others and not to be drained through compassion or call it empathy fatigue. But what I've learned is that when we identify with the suffering of others, it means that there, that seed of suffering in ourselves is there.
Mm-hmm.
That it becomes ours. It's not just out there. Right? But when we have a wise mind that comes from us, our you know, practice, a practice of looking deeply within ourselves, to have the clarity in the mental space of vastness, looking beyond the physical expression of what is here, but that encompasses the expression of what is here, then we come to appreciate that that is a part of life, and you know what we can do about it and what we cannot. And we're able to respond to that with clarity, with compassion, with equanimity, openness, and call it steadiness of mind and heart. Because when we're overwhelmed by empathetic fatigue, we can hardly regulate and take care of our own emotions or our own kind of, you know, experience of suffering in resonance with another person's suffering. So how can we actually be of any help to another? How can we have any clarity to see what is possible in our domain to be able to do something about it? So, you know, this poem, it resonates with me because it talks about the need for us to be awake, be present, be aware, to light the torch in ourselves and to be aware of our own clarity or non-clarity in order to be able to respond, you know, effectively through that clarity. I come from a collectivist culture. That is my inheritance of my family. And, you know, growing up in Canada, it's very confusing. There's a, you know, collectivist culture, the family says, you gotta be there for everybody. And then the opposite is, you know, the Western, you know, kind of individualist society. Oh, you gotta be independent. You gotta be on your own. You gotta, you know, take care of yourself. And, you know, that feels almost selfish. Right. And so, you know, for a long time, I was trying to figure out what's going on with this. Right. And very few people have this kind of challenge, especially when, you know, you've got two very valid domain of experience culturally that are in complete conflict with each other. Right? And so it's interesting to be able to find an integration and a balance between the two of them. Eh? And, you know, I mean, I just come out of a therapeutic session with a client morning, and I, you know, who's from similar background. And, you know, it dawned to me that if you're too independent, you've got so much walls up, you just shut up everyone from from yourself, right? You're cutting yourself off if you're too independent. And then if, you know, you are too collectivist, you know, you are too community oriented, then there's no boundaries. You don't know where somebody begins and you know, so where you begin and somebody ends, you know. It's just like there has to be a bit, you know, a kind of like synergy of balance between these two things. And I think it's not just someone like me who experienced this kind of experience. A lot of people have very similar experience, you know, growing up with conflicting messages, because the message in our society is one of empowerment, which is great. You know, like where Western culture is, you're responsible for everything. You're empowered. You know, you can do this. You know, you're independent. You're strong, right? You don't need anybody, right? So you know, you have, you know, unlike Asian culture, you know, you can have a set of everything in your kitchen. You know? You don't have to go borrow somebody else's stuff, you know. Whereas, you know, when I was young, growing up in Vietnam, my mom would send me over to the neighbors. Could you go over there and get some sugar? Then go get, you know, we ran out of sugar. Or could you go over there and get some salt? You know, that was quite common experience in my culture, and yeah, nobody bat an eye over it. It was like whatever. Imagine doing that in Canada. Can't you get your own? You know, it's very different culturally. It's a very different experience. And so I find that for us, we have to balance between that sense of empowerment that we're responsible for everything. And then there's that sense of collectivism, that we are an intricate, interconnected part of the whole system. Right. And we are subject to what the Buddha calls collective karma. Collective karma of our lived experience. Collective karma of our environment, our society, and our world. And, you know, that's what we're subject to. And it humbles us. Humbles me to recognize that that is what we must be aware of and accept. That even though, you know, we call it in Vietnam, you know, a locust trying to fight a locust trying to move a cart, a horse cart. It's overwhelming, right? We're struggling against the tide to make a difference in the world that we see. But at the same time, we can appreciate that the world has its own pattern, own trajectory that comes from collective pattern of civilization that cannot be changed by just one action. And of course, we might desire that we can change it, make a huge difference, an impact. And I think that Satyagraha, throughout his whole life, he made a huge impact in the world. you know, but he made a huge sacrifice as well. And the sacrifice is to his own health. He suffered a stroke. Sacrifice to his own time. He's constantly traveling, from what I know, since I've known him when I was a child. He's hearing from his students, who many of them are, well, I've known very well. And that he's traveled all the time, and he's constantly sick because of the horrendous travel schedule, almost like a rock star touring. And so we have to strike that balance between ourselves, our family, our society, our world. And that balance is what you choose in your clarity. So I ask, especially in our practice, find that clarity first. Find that peace in yourself first before you choose to act. Because if you act out of suffering, the non-clarity that comes from that act will generate karma, or the action that results in that. That's the seed that you're planting. If you act out of compassion, out of your own clarity and peace, you're bringing that seed, you're planting that seed in. So, you know, I spent a lot of time with activists when I was growing up, and I can tell you, a lot of them are very angry. Moved by anger, you know, they're moved by the injustice of it all. You know, there's a belief that life has to be just, and they're moved by that. And I can tell people that I was in that shoes before too, before I figured that out for myself. You know, that I felt like, you know, if we are moved by anger, we are moved by you know, this feeling of resistance to what is, then what we put out in the world is essentially the same. You can't stop war by another gun. The best way to stop war is by talking to each other, which is how most wars are stopped, right? There's people who just get so tired of fighting, they sit down and start talking. Now, we could do it beforehand, that'd be better, but if, you know, doing it at any time during the conflict is a good thing. So, you know, don't have that expectation that it's going to happen before or after, right? So as human beings, when we find our own peace inside, find our own clarity, we're able to regulate our own pain and suffering inside. We have more wisdom to be able to look into the world and see, what can I do in my domain that I'm capable of doing, that I'm capable of kind of planting that seed of. You know, a lot of my students know that I rarely talk about compassion. For the last 15 years of me teaching, you can count on your fingers how many times I talk about compassion. Because for me, compassion, it isn't not a concept. It is a lived experience, and a lived experience that comes from the practice itself, from clarity. Yeah? It's action. Action. Unconditional acceptance of what is, that is moved to action. And it's a very, very difficult way thing to explain to people what this entails. Almost have to experience it, because it comes from a domain of intense clarity and non-duality. As many of my students probably know, especially the ones who know me for a very, very long time, I never talk about compassion. Rarely do. I only talk about it probably in the last few years because there's a need for clarifying it. But I don't like giving people idea of what compassion is. I just like kind of want you to experience what it is. Because compassion is such a powerful moving force that arises from yourself, that arises from your own awakening, that arises from your own peace. Okay? And do I still do activism? I still do. Still a card-carrying member of, you know, political parties. Volunteer sometimes, you know. And I still do all this work. The difference is I know my limitations. I know, you know, out of the presence awareness, I know what I'm capable of and what I'm not capable of, and total acceptance of that. And therefore, when you move through the world that way, you're much more effective. that's my experience anyway. In each moment, you're much more effective. You know, it can be as simple as me walking a dog in the morning, and then I saw a bird on the ground, and my dog was trying to run over there and, you know, do what dogs do. It was as simple as me saying, stop! Leave that bird alone! You know? It's just that simple, right? If you're not aware, you're not, that, you know, been there, you're not present, you wouldn't have been able to react to that in the moment, right? And so a lot of times, you know, I remember when I was growing up, there's many times I bring home sick birds and I don't know what to do with them, and then they eventually die as a kid. And I was like, that's not compassion. That is really ignorance, because I've done that many times as a kid. You know, what I should have done is just call somebody else who knows what they're doing. And so when we are awake and aware and have that wisdom, our compassion in our efforts are much more effective. Moreover, like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Buddha says, if you can't find peace in yourself, how can you give it to other people? It's just literally impossible. It's almost like I'm thirsty. I need water, but I'm going to try to give you some. It just doesn't make any sense, right? And that's literally is our practice. It's how we get to approach the world. Conflicts in the world is not new. It's as old as human history. How is it that we are able to be effective in our ways of being in the world, in acting and moving compassion? But one of those ways is me being here on Saturday. I've been here on Saturday for many, many Saturdays. And, I never thought of myself as a Zen teacher. I never see myself as teaching, you know, as helping anybody. I'm just here. Just here, sharing my experience and practice. And when my teacher asked me to teach, I was moved. Like he said, the searching for the Dharma. There's no Dharma teacher. There's no Zen teacher, meditation teacher in Regina at all at that time. You want to deprive them of that? And I was like, nope. There's a little bit of guilt going on there. But I know in myself, you know, I'm capable of doing that. I'm capable of sharing that, even though, you know, I lacked a lot of skills when I first started. I was 33 years old. I was a young kid. people tell me, you know, and sometimes people remind me, they walk to my same class and they go, you're really young. I was like, oh, yes, I know. you look at yourself, you know, through the lens of equanimity, through the lens of I'm no longer feeling any anxiety or any pain of, you know, empathetic feelings with others? Do I have clarity and peace in myself? And this clarity and peace, what way can I to express this compassion? Well, you can't sleep at night, then that's the most compassionate thing to do is go to sleep. Remember, in liberation of all sentient beings, you are one of the sentient beings. If you can't liberate yourself first, you can't liberate anybody, okay? And that's a reminder that I always, always tell myself, because it's very easy to lose yourself in this compassionate work. Whether you're doing it voluntarily, like myself, for a long time, or you're doing it, you know, professionally, actually like myself now, it's very easy to lose yourself in this work of compassion, right? To forget, to take care of yourself, to forget that your spheres of influence, your the action that you can do is what is available in front of you now. It is not the work of some ideas or concept. Is what is available, accessible to you now. So in my practice, I always remind myself when I have a, you know, lofty ideas or things like that, you know, what I want to do about the future. Of course, you have to have some in order to plan. And when I feel a little bit of anxiety, which all of us feel, it's kind of healthy to have some sometimes, I would ask myself, what am I expecting? What am I trying to control? What am I trying to do that's more than what is available now, right? And those questions kind of answer itself very quickly. It brings you back to the present, brings you back to reality, brings you back to awakening. So your wise mind can come up and see reality for what it is and respond to it effectively. Every time I find I sit in front of someone I'm trying to help and I desire something, whether it's a desire to change them or desire for myself, it always messes up. For me, anyway, I always mess up. I'm always not as effective as when I totally accept and surrender to the moment and just allow it to naturally flow. You know, in this work of teaching Zen and doing Zen counseling, I call it Zen counseling to people for many, many years, I found that the most effective way to help them is to be present. Sometimes I sit down with a person in conversations and the whole room would light up. That's because my pupil dilates. This has nothing. When you're just like really, really present, relax, you're 100%. Something miraculous happens. Fall into this state of being that's completely open. Then what happens? My people die. I don't know if there's a physiological reason for that, but that happens to me a lot. Sometimes it freaks people out. So my pupil dilates and the room just lights up. I've noticed the room lights up because my pupil dilates. But I've noticed it. Person with whatever is in front of them, it becomes this incredible soul. No matter what is unfolding. And in that presence, the person in front of you can feel it. You can sense it. It's not an intellectual thing. And all the boundaries just between two people just fall. very easily. So, the work of a Zen teacher, for me, I feel it's a work of a healer. Probably the most traditional healer there is in Asian society, right? Back then, you didn't go to a therapist or a psychotherapist to talk about your troubles. You had troubles, you just go to a temple and find the most prolific meditators, usually in Vietnam. Find the most perfect prolific meditators and then try to talk to them about your problems. And this is how it's done in the Shuaishan society. So in Western world, this role is replaced by psychotherapists, by different types of therapists. And that's fine too. Whatever paradigm that people are approaching. For me, the work of healing others is about healing yourself first. I talk to other therapists who, in the profession, and there's this idea of Jung's idea of the wounded healer. And we talked about this in graduate school, Jung's idea of the wounded healer. I talk to myself. Yeah, that's kind of I hope you heal yourself first before you try to heal other people, because as a doctor, especially if you work in the emergency, like if you're bleeding, how can you help somebody stop a bleed, right? So it just doesn't make sense for me. I think, healing yourself is probably the first and foremost important work that you can do. Help heal the world. Because if you can't heal yourself, it's almost like having a bleeding wound and you're trying to patch somebody's wound up. Okay, that works pretty a little bit okay if you're in the middle of a war. If your wound is not that serious. But if you're literally bleeding out and you're trying to patch somebody up, that's just not working. Right? So it sounds a little bit selfish that in Zen we have to practice to heal ourselves first. To be able to find our own peace first before we do anything for the world. I would say that you can do both at the same time, but watch yourself as you're trying to do something for the world and see how much suffering you're experiencing. And that means that you still have things to work on yourself. Because you're bringing that energy to the work of compassion. Are you planting the seed of awakening, or are you planting the seed of pain? So I always remember Mr. Vong. We call him Uncle Vong, I knew from Toastmasters. He's a lawyer in Vietnam. He was a lawyer in Vietnam, taught at military college. And he suffered terribly after the war because they put him through what you call re-education. And of course, it's work camp, labor, hard labor camp, and communist mind cleansing camp, re-education camp. He was in there for 6 years. And when he came to Canada, he worked, he didn't retrain as a lawyer. He settled in Quebec because he spoke fluent French. And English, and eventually he ended up in Toronto and was a part of Toastmaster International that came and helped train me in the club that I established in the community. And I asked him why didn't you have any kind of anger or a frustration or activism against communism, because you suffer so much during the war and after. And he told me, he says, I don't have any animosity or any ill will towards communist Vietnamese, non-Vietnamese, because I felt it was just one big misunderstanding. People are not talking to each other properly. And so, now I'm participating in Toastmasters. communicate effectively. So he spent most of his, you know, life that I knew up to that point, being a Toastmaster, coaching other people to communicate effectively with each other. And he was he's a great mentor for me. And you know, a lot of my skills right now came from his mentorship in being able to communicate the ideas that I have, experiences that I have, and the practice that I have then. So I tell people, you know, be an effective Zen teacher. It's not just about experience what you experience. You gotta have some skills, right? And one of those skills I learned from Uncle Pong, who had great wisdom. He didn't practice any meditation or anything. He just had the wisdom, you know, that he had learned and reflected through his suffering. That, you know, suffering comes from the lack of understanding, the lack of connecting, truly connecting with each other. And lack of true communication with each other. And so this is what we see in the world. Right? We see conflict, we see suffering, we see war through the lens of all these, call it the discord of communication. That it arises out of ignorance, it arises out of people's own internal suffering that they put out in the world. Honestly, I wouldn't want to be Trump or Putin because their interior experience, it's awful. If you see it expressed out like that, you're living it part-time. They're living it full-time. You know? So I look at them and I go, you know, I have a lot of compassion for them. Why? Because they're living in their head full-time with all that conflict, right? So what I tell people, if you have all the conflict inside yourself, you know, and you feel bad about exposing that to other people, well, you know what? They're exposed to it part-time or even casually, but you are exposed to it full-time. So feel sorry for you first so that you can have self-compassion to look at it and to nurture, you know, to embrace all of that and accept it and then eventually change it. So, you know, looking out to the world, the reason why we suffer when we witness a war, we witness atrocity, we witness, you know, all of these challenges of humanity, which in time immemorial has always been happening, right? But we suffer when we witness all of that and we're kind of feel helpless, feel victim, even identified. What we're essentially experiencing is the suffering of, I call it the basic humanity of suffering. It's always happening, right? But what can we do that is different? And liberate ourselves from that suffering and then help others to liberate themselves. So take responsibility to change the world. I used to say this all the time. So you want to help the world? And this is through my own experience, as well as I see various Titnyakan as well. You want to change the world. And the world is a crazy place. World, I call it one big mental health institution, okay? That's what the world is. But just because everybody has the same illness doesn't mean that it's not. That's it. It's you know, acceptable. Well, it's acceptable because everybody has the same illness. So that's how the Buddha sees it. The world's crazy. Help the world by take one person. You. So your family, your friends, your people you come across don't have to deal with that patient. And that is the first thing that you can do that can be empowering to you, to other people, is to empower yourself to end your own suffering. Help other people by helping yourself. Okay? Don't expose other people to the full-time suffering that you're experiencing by giving them casual visitations to it. When they come across you, you know? What you bring into the world, it's what you have inside. So how you can help the world is to find peace and clarity in yourself. And then all your actions in the world, call it perfumes in Buddhist literature, they call it perfuming everywhere you go. You know, when someone walks into a room, somebody wears perfume, you know, the whole room smells it just by diffusion. That's the experience of a practitioner, of a Zen practitioner. It just doesn't affect themselves only. Eventually, people around them are going, different now. What happened? What have you been doing, right? And if that you get that comment, then you know your practice is going somewhere. It's have an effect on yourself and hopefully have an effect on perfuming the environment. So I hope that, you know, the war and the conflict on the external will change, but we all know that it's not going to happen. It's a part of human history. It's a part of, I call it, collective karma. It's a cyclic existence, you know, samsara. That's what we're living in. But we're not resigned to that. We are empowered to change that in ourselves, to end the war in ourselves, to end the suffering in ourselves, so that we can help others. And I feel that is a natural work of somebody who's awake. It doesn't matter. You can't help it. You cannot help it. And you don't have to be a Zen teacher to do that. I mean, people become much more effective at what they're doing in their profession, in their family, in their community, when their own practice improves, you know, progress and find peace in themselves. Buddha says, be unto yourself, awake and light. The six patriarchs said, one spark of light takes away 1,000 years of darkness.
This podcast is created by members of the Clearway Zen Sangha. If you enjoyed the talk and wish to show support, donation information can be found on our website, www.clearwayzen.ca. Thank you for listening.